Interviewing Paul tonight is a man who himself needs no introduction to Melbourne audiences, 774 ABC Melbourne's Raphael Epstein. Please join me in welcoming Raphael and Paul Simon.
Welcome to Melbourne, first of all.
Thank you. Thanks, Raph.
Great to have the chance to chat to you. Now, I've read that you first heard Elvis. I like this story because it's about the car radio, and I'm on the car radio. That you first heard Elvis in a supermarket car park on the car radio. Can you tell me if that's true and just tell me a bit more about that?
Well, yes, that's true. I was in my parents' car, and they were going to a supermarket, and the announcer said, here's a singer that they say every time he performs in the South, people just scream and go crazy, and his name is Elvis Presley, and I thought that was one of the strangest names I had ever heard. And then they played That's All Right, Mama. That's the first time. It's funny that it stayed as a memory, because I don't think I particularly liked the song immediately, you know, but yeah, that's true.
Was that part of the spark? I mean, I've also read about you. I think you recall your father praising your singing once. I just wonder when you first think that you switched on to the idea of singing and music and those things.
Well, you know, when I was in the fourth grade, which would be, I guess, 10 or 11,
yep.
Something like that. While we waited for our school bus to pick us up, they would have different kids come up and perform. And up walks this blonde-haired boy, you know, curly blonde hair, and he sings this song called They Tried to Tell Us We're Too Young, which is kind of hilarious when you're 10. I think of it. And everybody really, really was, they did go crazy for this.
Yeah, right.
Which I made a note of that. That boy happened to have been Art Garfunkel,
as it
happens. And I thought, that's interesting. So you sing, and people pay a lot of attention to you. But still, I wasn't doing anything. I was cast in a school play, Alice in Wonderland, and I was practicing singing in my room, and my dad, who was a musician, was on his way out to some gig, and he stuck his head in, and he said, oh, you have a nice voice, Paul. So I thought,
And
maybe
when,
I'll get up and sing.
When did you think that it would be what you would do forever? I mean, I know you have a song that's actually released that gets you on TV, I think, while you're still at school. But you complete your studies. I wonder at what stage you went, right, this is my thing. I'm not going to be doing anything else.
13.
Yeah, right. So what happens at 13?
At 13, I think I decided this is what I like to do the most. I didn't say that to anybody, but certainly not my father. But I'm pretty sure that I made that decision, at least emotionally anyway. I mean, I wasn't really thinking about career.
No, sure.
At 13, and I often think now, and over the years, every time I, you know, find myself in some sort of situation where I can't, nothing is coming in terms of writing, and I'm in a bad mood about it. I think it's a 13-year-old's decision.
Right.
You don't have to do it. You don't want to do it. don't do it. And then I think, yeah, but I do like. I said, well, if you like it, then stop complaining. And you like it. This is part of the process. Now I really don't complain. Now I don't think, I used to think of it as these long periods of sort of nothing happening as possibly described as writer's block, you know, but I now think of it as more like writer's conundrum, you know, problems that you can't really solve at the moment. I mean, there's a reason why I'm being negative about something.
Yeah.
And the editor, I mean, that's the cause of writer's block, I think, is the editor, our internal editor jumps on us immediately and says, that's no good. No, that's not a good idea. That won't work. No, everybody knows that. That's a bad idea. Well, give me a chance, at least. Let me, you know, do all these bad ideas before you say that's
okay.
Bad.
So are you more liberal with yourself now? Are you more willing to let yourself make mistakes? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think of them as mistakes. I think of them as some sort of foray into an area, and maybe it feels after a little while like I don't belong in this neighborhood. I have nothing to say about this, or the way I write now is I don't write lyrics till the last part of the process. I make the music first. If it's a rhythm song, I start with drums, and I find a groove that I like, and I improvise guitar against it, and that tells me the key that I'm going to be in, and it tells me something about the style I'm in, and something generically about it. And once I know that, then I think in this particular genre, what kind of conversation would be appropriate mm-hmm. in that context? And then I sort of look for some topic that would be appropriate in that musical context. And that takes a while. And now I'm willing to say I haven't found the conversation yet. You know, I found the context. And I enjoy actually making the context much more than I enjoy writing the lyrics.
Right. Has that changed much? I've read actually quite a bit about, I have no idea if these stories are apocryphal or not, the writing Sounds of Silence with the one candle in the bath running to sort of aid your concentration. I wonder if are you still essentially going through the same process of the triggers that you use to get the creative juices flowing?
Yes.
Are they still essentially the same, or have you learned things and matured?
Well, both. I mean, when I wrote The Sound of Silence, I was just 21 years old, and it came sort of quickly, and the editor in me wasn't so harsh, and I thought, that's pretty good. And really had no idea, certainly had no idea that was going to be something that would last for 50 years past that. But so when you're young, you don't know anything, and that's a big advantage. Because you think, you're saying something for the first time, because it is the first time for you. And there's so much life going on within you. You fall in love, you get your heart broken, everything is amazing, and there's usually no deep sorrow that's occurred yet. So it's easy to write these songs when you're that age, and the older you get, the more you say, yes, that's true, but the opposite is also true, and the subject matter gets more complex, and as it gets more complex, the music gets more complex, and then as the complexities intertwine, some songwriterly instinct says, either that's good or no, that's too confusing. Mm. Nobody will know what you're talking about here. I don't know what I'm talking about here. Actually, maybe that isn't true. All kinds of things. But eventually, things become simpler, and I feel that I can say, well, that's true. I believe what I'm saying now. It doesn't mean that I think it's particularly insightful or original or anything like that, but at least I know it's not a lie. And therefore, I'm willing to say, okay, that's a song. Mm. And, I may be more interested in what happened harmonically than I am lyrically. And at a certain point, I say it's done. Done, you know, except actually they're never done.
So who do you bounce off? I'm interested in collaboration. And again, Sounds of Silence gets re-released with, I think I'm right, with extra instruments. So I don't know if you call that collaboration or modification. I wonder too if the way you thought about bouncing off other people and having other people's input, has that changed over time?
Well, everything changes over time. That early recording of The Sound of Silence when I was in my 20s, which I recorded with Art Garfunkel, was originally the two voices and an acoustic guitar. And then that came out and it wasn't a hit. And somewhere within a year, the record company decided to overdub electric instruments and drums.
And they're Dylan's musicians at the time, aren't they?
It was the same producer.
Right, okay.
We had the same producer as Bob Dylan. So he used the same musicians, and they re-released The Sound of Silence, which was getting sort of some kind of response from small radio stations around the U.S. And when they re-released it, it was a big hit. And that's the way that song, it represented a certain something about the zeitgeist of the 60s that very well. When I sang it at the 10th anniversary of 9/11, I sang it completely differently. And it meant something that was completely different. Now, I mean, there's something about The Sound of Silence, for whatever reason, that changed its shape enough to be meaningful in one decade and to be meaningful in another way decades later. I don't know why I didn't plan for that, but I certainly understood it when I decided to sing, because they said, would you sing on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and would you sing Bridge Over Troubled Water? And I said, oh, sure, of course I will. And then I thought, I think The Sound of Silence actually is going to be more meaningful than Bridge Over Troubled Water. I don't know why, but I feel like it will be. And so I sang it, and part of what I think is that the listener completes the song.
Mm.
And that's true all the time. The listener hears it and makes it into, if in fact they embrace the song, makes it into some relevant part of their own thinking or their own emotional life, and the song takes hold and becomes a valuable song to them.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with that song. I mean, I think if I played the exact same folk rock version that was originally recorded on the anniversary of 9/11, it would have been inappropriate.
So does that help you to answer where it comes from? If you see songs have such great resonance with people over a long period of time, and you say the meaning of that song changes, does that help give you an idea of where the creativity comes from, what the muse is? I mean, you speak about getting the feel for the context and getting the feel for the conversation, but I haven't asked you, I mean, do you have an idea of what you're tapping into when the creativity flows, where that comes from?
Not really. But I guess I could. I enjoy the fact that I don't know where it comes from. It's a mystery, and I don't have any inclination to solve that mystery because I enjoy the mystery. I know that after a certain period of time, that 13-year-old is going to say, I know a good melody or that phrase is interesting, and then I'm going to begin again. And it just has always been that way. And I really don't know why. I just think that that's my personality type. I mean, I really never called myself an artist until I was in my 40s. I really didn't want to be called an artist. It was, but
what were you?
I was just a songwriter, a musician, but an artist meant something different to me. And then I thought, no, I am an artist. Saying that I'm an artist doesn't mean that I'm saying that I'm a good artist. It's just a personality type. It's just a thing that it's just who I am. I make up things. Sometimes they're people like them, and in my life it happened quite a lot. And sometimes they don't, and that's what's going on all the time. There's always some percentage of the population that makes up things, and that nourishes people in an artistic way. And I'm one of the people who do that. If what I make up is not nourishing, and it's rejected, well, no problem, because somebody else is making up something, and people are still getting what they need.
Yeah.
So that's really all it is. So when the mystery occurs again, I'm grateful, because I really enjoy it.
Yeah.
And
is that the best thing?
That's the best thing.
Yeah. So that's your number one rush or experience in life, or not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. And if you break it down and analyze it, I mean, what's going on is you're getting a flood of dopamine into the frontal cortex, and you are actually getting a rush. I mean, and when you break down the dopamine into opioids, you have an addiction.
But
you want it again, you know?
Do you think it's that simple? I mean, do you see a broader dimension to it? I mean, I suspect
a lot of people... Well, I think that's what's going on in the brain. I wouldn't say it was simple. I think that's part of the explanation.
There's nothing spiritual or magical going on as well?
You could call it spiritual or magical. It would be all right, you could say dopamine was spiritual and magical. It would be. I'm just giving you one way of looking at what's going on and why it is that I keep doing this, where the pleasure comes from and the intensity of the pleasure. I mean, and in fact, when I was younger and songs flowed more easily, and I was rewarded more often with that, you would think that as it's slowed down now that I'm older, that I would be less inclined to do it. But instead, it's that experiment, you know, with the rats, with, you know, tapping on to get your food. You know, after a while, the less food you give them, the more frantically they tap on the thing. And that's the same. I think, you know, I'm just a frantic little rat tapping on a...
I want to take you back to you calling yourself an artist, and I wonder about your how you refine being an artist. If I've read the story of your life correctly, sort of the early 80s, you're feeling not in the best of ways, and perhaps at a bit of a loss and judging yourself too much. I wonder what led you down the path towards South Africa. I know someone sent you some music, but I wonder what led you down that path when many people around you thought that wouldn't be a successful or a good idea?
Well, You know, all of these things, they're, you can keep pulling on the thread and going backwards and backwards. What happened immediately before Graceland, that album, was an album called Hearts and Bones, which was the first album that I had put out as a solo artist after leaving Simon and Garfunkel that wasn't a really big hit. And part of the reason for that, well, there were lots of kind of reasons for it, but well, it's a bit mundane, but I'll go through it just to show you how it's just ordinary life that twists you and head pushes you in a certain direction. The group that I recorded with, the musicians that I recorded with in the album prior to Hearts and Bones, that album was called Still Crazy After All These Years. It was a very talented group of New York studio musicians. By the time we got up to Hearts and Bones, these guys were so in demand by everybody, partly because of them having great success with me, but they also had great success with others, that they were exhausted a little bit creatively. It was also the time of cocaine, and so there was too much of that going on, so it wasn't the same discipline, it wasn't the same energy. And when I came in with the songs, the record that we produced was not exactly the record that I envisioned in my mind. It wasn't played as well, probably for those reasons. Also, just to show you again, the record before Hearts and Bones was One Trick Pony. It was this movie I did, One Trick Pony, which I took on the task of writing a movie because the album before that won a Grammy for Best Album, and I said, well, now I've proven my point. It wasn't just Simon and Garfunkel and Bridge Over Troubled Water. It's like, I can do it on my own, and now I just did it, and now what challenge would I like, you know, can I take on? And I decided to write a screenplay and to make, you know, be in a movie and do that, which I did, and on a very low level of competence. As you would imagine, somebody who was doing something for a first timer.
It's not so well received either, the film, is it?
Was it well received? I don't think it was even noticed, you know. It wasn't terrible. It didn't deserve to be well received. But anyway, that's what happened. Then at that time, a promoter in New York said to me, would you do a concert in Central Park? Play a concert in Central Park. And I thought, yeah, I will. I should do a concert in Central Park, but I've just had this movie that was a flop. So maybe I should ask Artie to come and sing on part of the concert to like a kind of insurance policy. And then I thought, no, wait a minute, if I do that, then Simon and Garfunkel will have to close the concert. That means I have to open as a solo. That means I have to open for Simon and Garfunkel. I don't want to open for Simon and Garfunkel. I better make the whole thing Simon and Garfunkel. So I made the whole thing Simon and Garfunkel. It was a giant hit. 500,000 people showed up. We then decided to have a reunion and go and play more concerts. Of course, we couldn't stand each other. And we were out. We had no business being in in a reunion. It wasn't about music at all. It was all about a whole bunch of people saying that they really liked us at one time. So, and this album that I was writing, Hearts and Bones, which we announced, we'll make this album together. It'll be a Simon and Garfunkel album. Well, by the time we finished the tour, we just weren't even speaking. And I said, this is the last thing I feel like doing is doing this album with you. So then I had to say to everybody, oh, by the way, that Simon and Garfunkel album, it's not. It's going to be this, just me with my exhausted, coked out musicians. So everything...
The 80s sound pretty hectic to you.
So everything predictably fell apart. And when I finished, I thought, I'm not going to go through this process in the same way again. I'm not going to write songs, bring them into a studio, and hope that the record that we make will be exciting and appropriate enough to the songs. I'm going to make the record first exciting and appropriate, which is what I spoke of earlier. I'm going to make the context what I want, and then I have enough skills that I will write the song in front of that. Coincidentally with that, I heard this music that I really fell in love with, and it turned out that the music came from South Africa. So following that music, I found that I could go and record in South Africa with those musicians, and I decided, good, I'll go there and I'll record with these musicians and I'll record everything that I want, and then I'll write the songs based on all of this history that I told you about that led me to start thinking that way. And so I reversed the way that I wrote from that point on until the last album that I did, where I said, no, I've been doing this for 20 some odd years now. I've been starting with a musical premise or a rhythmic premise and gradually building into a lyrical flowering of whatever the song is. And now that's become too familiar a process. And now it would be better for me to be uncomfortable and go back to sitting with a guitar and making up a song, which is harder than saying, play something on the drums. Oh, I like that. I'll keep that. Mm. You know, in other words, I was, before that, creating stimuli and responding to it.
Yes.
My early songs, I wasn't doing that. I was doing everything. So I went back on the last album and started to write that way and made a much, much better album because of it. So I can write it either way. I can start from nothing with a blank page, which is the most uncomfortable, or I can, you know, have a page that already has lines and things on it and fill in the lines. And either way produces songs. I'm not sure that one way produces a better song than the other. I'm not even sure anymore what is a really good song. Now that I've passed the point where I'm not writing hits, I'm not trying to write hits. Yeah. I'm not interested in popular music today.
No.
I wouldn't want to write in that style anyway. I'm sort of only interested in the form, the art form, and I'm in my own world. So you have to stop judging it then and saying, you know, is this good or is this not? All I say is it truthful enough to say it's a song, and then I let it go and hope, you know, hopefully it is a good song. That's how it worked now.
I wanted to ask a little bit about politics, not so much what your politics is, but whether or not the experience of going to South Africa, having musicians oppose what you were doing because you were breaking the boycott, I just wonder if that influenced your politics. I was fascinated to read things like Billy Bragg protesting outside your concert at some, it must be the late 80s in London, because you've broken the boycott by going to South Africa and doing that. I wonder if going through all of that, you seem to be quite a political person, did going against the grain in that way inform how you see the world politically? Did it change your views?
Yes, but that's not an accurate description of what happened.
Mm-hmm. I get that a lot.
What happened? What happened was there was no official boycott. There was an Artists Against Apartheid movement that said, we don't want anybody being in any trade relationships with South Africa. We want to isolate the apartheid regime. We don't want anyone participating in political dialogue with the South African regime. We don't want any athletic contests to be held in segregated stadiums with segregated teams, and we don't want anyone to perform in front of segregated audiences. And the way performers got around that was they went to Sun City, which is in Botswana, and that's where they performed. Well, I was asked to perform there, and I already knew that was the way they were going around it, and I said, no, I'm not going to perform there. Nobody said, maybe they never thought of it, probably, nobody said you couldn't go to South Africa and record with Black South African musicians. That was never said anywhere in this boycott, which if you tried to find the boycott, if you were an American, you really couldn't find it. It was more clearly articulated in Great Britain, maybe here, I don't know. But in America, we just knew the apartheid regime was ugly, and that it was a crime there. And that was that. When I wanted to go to South Africa, I called up a South African producer, who actually is, I'll see, he's Australian now.
Yes.
Hilton Rosenthal. And I said, can I come there? And he said, yes, you can. So I took that to mean there's nothing to stop you. I mean, he didn't say there was anything to stop me. So I went. Nobody said anything to me when I was there. Mm. There were some objections, but the South African producers kept them from me.
All right.
They wanted me to come because they felt South African music was relegated to being third world music, and they felt that it was really deserving of being mainstream mm-hmm. world music. And here was a guy who was a well-known pop artist who wants to come to South Africa. Great, we can use him, and we'll work with him. That was me. And so they wanted me to come because that was good for the South African music in general. The musicians wanted me to come because what I was paying them was I think double the union scale of America, which was, I think it was like about $500 a day.
So a lot more than they would have received.
They were making $10 a day. So they were happy to take the job. Most of them didn't know who I was. I wanted to go because I really liked the music, and it wasn't that I thought that the music was going to be a hit. It wasn't like I said to someone, I know how to bounce back from Hearts and Bones. I'll go to South Africa and get musicians from the hill, the country, and that's going to put me back on the top of the charts. I mean, I didn't even bother to tell anybody. So there was no objection. There was no mention of any boycott. There was none of that. I recorded there in South Africa for about 10 days. I found it very uncomfortable. The racial tension was palpable. And I recorded five tracks there. And then I brought those musicians out of South Africa and recorded Ladysmith Black Mambazo in London, the other guys in New York, and I finished the record outside of South Africa. Still, no objections from anybody, nothing. Went on television and performed two of the songs. There was a tremendous reaction to it, although the record hadn't come out, but a tremendous reaction. No objections. The record came out, it got almost universally great reviews.
Yeah.
And became a big hit.
Favorites.
About 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, the first attacks came. Hey, you know, you shouldn't have done that. You didn't ask. You didn't ask permission. So I said, well, nobody told me I had to ask permission. Was I supposed to ask permission from? They said the ANC, African National Congress. I said, well, okay, can I have a meeting with the ANC? By now, I hadn't hooked up with Hugh Masekela yet, but I went to the ANC in New York, and I said, look, I don't want to have a fight with you. I didn't mean anything. I'm on your side. I support you. You know, you're Mandela. I support you. I'll be happy to do a concert and say, I support the ANC. You know, and they said, sorry, the problem is you didn't ask. We have no objection to the fact that you recorded with black musicians. The problem is you didn't ask our permission. So I said, oh, so is that the kind of government that you're going to be? Well, to ask permission to, you know, can I say this lyric? Can I do that? You know, you're going to be like all governments. You're going to just screw over the artists. Mm. That's what you're going to be. And so we were in a fight. Fortunately for me, I began to tour with Hugh Masekela, who I'd known for a long time, because Tom Wilson, mm-hmm. who we put the electric instruments on Sound of Silence, was Hugh Masekela's producer yeah. as well, and so I knew him. And Hugh Masekela said, what you did is fine, it's going to be great, we need to get Miriam Makeba to join us, because believe me, when it starts to get nasty, you really want Miriam to be there. And so the fight ensued, mostly in Great Britain.
Yeah, it was big there.
It was bigger there because the leader of the ANC in Great Britain was a guy named Dolly Tombo, who was 25 years old at the time. His father...
He's the man you end up having the genial
right.
argument with in the documentary.
That's right. Yeah. His father was Oliver Tambo, who was Nelson Mandela's law partner. And Oliver Tambo was a great hero of the revolution and of the cause of the anti-apartheid movement. Dolly Tambo was not raised in South Africa because it was too dangerous, because his father was a wanted man. So Dolly Tambo grew up in London, wealthy in London, and was now the head of the ANC. Now I'm going to get Freudian on you because nobody ever said this. But I say, well, here's a guy who says, hey, I like to be a tough guy too. And I can't have a gun, I can't do that. I can only be the head of the ANC in London, so I'm not gonna let Paul Simon get away with this. And I'm just going to insist on it, that we're not going to give in. And so for Hugh Masekela said, I knew that kid when he was born. It's hilarious that he's going to like have this fight with us. So all of these undercurrents are going on. So really what's happening is, in the name of altruistic embracing of apartheid, is really a battle of egos. His ego, my ego, the South African musicians who felt like, don't tell me what that I can't play here. I can play where I want to play. The ANC is going to tell me, well, and this is as far as the world knew, the ANC represented everything. But yeah. But for the guys in the Graceland troop, you had half the troop who were Zulu, and they were supporters of Inkatha.
Yeah.
And that was opposed to the ANC, and they didn't like the ANC because they were Xhosa.
Yeah.
So, but we didn't say any of this. This wasn't a discussion that I was going to go and have in a press conference and say, oh, wait a second, not everybody in this group here supports the ANC. And personally, I did support the ANC and did not support Inkatha.
Yeah.
Well, that was Buthelezi. And why didn't I support Buthelezi? Well, because the rumor was that should there be an open civil war, that the Zulus had made a deal with the Boers, that they would unite, and should they win, that the Zulus would have their own country, KwaZulu. And the Zulus are a tribe of 5 million people who really feel like we're the biggest tribe and we're the toughest tribe in South Africa, and we kicked the British ass. Mm. We deserve to have our own country. So that's who they were. Ladysmith Black Mambazo, that's all Zulu from KwaZulu. Miriam, that's not Zulu. That comes from the Nelson Mandela world. Then there's the Azapa, which is to the far left. They were the ones who threw the bomb into the promoter's office. They were opposed to everybody. Except Azapo. So, I mean, it was a very...
Minefield.
It was a very political, intricate political fight that was going on. And we became a metaphor for this fight.
Yeah.
When you break it down, this is what was going on. People had an agenda, and so did I. And my agenda was I wanted to play the music that I wanted to play with the musicians that I wanted to play it with.
How does the music sound now? Because we actually played with the re-released album, which is last year, isn't it? And we had a really strong response, actually, when I played a few tracks.
It sounds pretty good, I think.
Well, what did you think and feel when you hear it again last year? Do you have the same response?
No, I didn't have the same response, no, because I knew it, I mean, but I thought that it held up pretty well.
Yeah.
Considering, I thought it held up well. Once I finish something, I mean, I'm sort of...
You're done.
I'm on to the next thing, and I don't look back too often.
So, because I'm interested in that, because you were talking about in the early 80s, you do the well-known concert in Central Park, but you didn't feel like you were doing it for the right reasons. I was watching a YouTube clip this morning. I think it's 2006 when you do another Central Park.
No, 1991.
So is it 91, is it?
Simon and Garfunkel's 81. 1991 is when I did the one by myself in Central Park.
Okay, but look, I can't remember the year. But I just wonder, I mean, you revisit.
Oh, 2006.
Somewhere in the 2000s. I just wonder, when you revisit those performances with Art Garfunkel, and you're saying that in the early 80s you weren't doing it for the right reasons, that hasn't stopped you going back and, playing the songs that people have huge emotional connections to. When is it, under what circumstances are you playing, I don't know, Sounds of Silence, Bridge Over Troubled Water, Mrs. Robinson? When is it the right time? When is it a good thing for you? And when is it you're doing it for the wrong reasons for other people?
Well, Artie and I have known each other since we were 11. And we were best friends then. And we were always capable, even at this young age, of sort of... And we were always arguing. And we were always capable of sort of getting right to the core of the argument and say, okay, or let's just quit it. And we would. And by the time, now that reunion, that reunion, it wasn't natural, because I did it out of a fear that I wasn't going to succeed. Mm. But other reunions, we would have a conversation beforehand, and I would say, look, let's get it down, let's get it straight, what we want to accomplish, okay? So that you're satisfied and I'm satisfied, and the experience turns into a satisfying experience for us, and at the end of it, we feel good about each other. And so, you know, let's not just go out there and be miserable for money. That's like a bad job that pays well. So we would when we had those conversations and set out to do what we wanted, and we were careful of each other's feelings and what it is that we wanted to accomplish. And then I felt when we revisited those songs that they were meaningful. Sometimes I felt it personally, because I could think of who I was writing about and the time that it occurred. And sometimes it was because I could sense that the audience responded to it in a way that was very emotional, and I could feel that. And so, as I said before, I think that the listener completes the song. Mm.
Is that completion, is that expectation, is it ever too much? Do you ever feel like people are, I don't know, hunting or mining for something that you can't deliver?
No, I don't judge. No, I don't judge. It's their, that's their right to finish the song. That's part of the process. You know, I finish it for myself, and then they finish it, and they decide.
Yeah.
I love that song. It's my favorite song. I can't stand that. Turn it, you know, that all those reactions that people have.
Okay. And now, look, I don't have a watch. I just want to give people a chance to. Oh, okay. Right. So it's already 7:30. I better give people a chance. Sorry, I left my phone there, so I wasn't able to keep track of time. Why don't we give people a chance to ask their own questions? We've got a few microphones. I think I'll just pick people whose hands are up. You might just want to say your name too, so that Paul knows, the lady at the back there, so Paul knows who he's talking to.
Can you hear me? Thanks, my name's Jenny. Thank you, Mr. Simon, for so many years of wonderful music and heartfelt love, I guess, of touching my heart. I don't know if this is a fair question. I hope you can answer it, or if you feel to. I've heard some musicians say, when asked the question, what are your favourites of all of the songs that you've written? What are your favourites? And musicians often say, they're like my children and I love them all equally. Are you able to say, and maybe songs that get the dopamine flowing for you, are there favourites that you have? Thank you.
I guess. You know, it's not a subject that I enjoy thinking about. But if I had to say, I would say out of the Simon and Garfunkel period, I would say that I liked Sound of Silence, Bridge Over Troubled Water, The Boxer, Mrs. Robinson a little bit less. Maybe those are the ones I liked. In the next period of time, I liked Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard. I liked that song. Still Crazy After All These Years, I liked that one. Slip Sliding Away, I liked. I don't know. You know, out of Graceland, I think I liked Graceland the most. And then in the albums that came after, in the songs that weren't hits, you know, there are songs that I think are... They're very satisfying to me because I feel like I got it. I said what I wanted to say, and I said it well by my own standards. Like on my last album, there's a song called Love in Hard Times. It's a very good song in my self-estimation. And there's another song called Questions for the Angels that's also a really interesting song. Seems to me it's an interesting song. So I don't, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say favorites, but you know, sometimes a song, some songs are just better than others, and as the years go by, you may change your mind. I may change my mind. That's why I don't listen, because I'm really not concerned with thinking about that.
This gentleman down the front here.
I was in New York, I can't remember when it was, but the Cape Man was on. Mm-hmm. And I was a big fan, and I said to my friend who I was with, we've got to go and see it. And I loved it, it's beautiful music. But whenever I read about it, it's always presented as something that it wasn't successful.
Well, it wasn't successful.
I know that, but why do you think it wasn't successful, and what are your thoughts about the play, the music? How do you think about it?
Well, it wasn't great, you know, but it was pretty interesting. And the music was very good. Why wasn't it successful? I can only speculate. Part of the reason was, at that time on Broadway, there was a kind of resentment towards anyone that came out of rock into Broadway. It's like the complete opposite of now. It's now, it's just... it's a big advantage. The subject matter was, it was a controversial subject matter. It was based on a true story that had an impact on me growing up in New York. It was about a Puerto Rican 16-year-old who got into a fight, you know, in a schoolyard and killed two kids. And to me, it was a story about New York in 1959, about race, and about sort of just before the what I think of as the modern age. It's Eisenhower. It's when haven't gotten to Kennedy, which sort of begins modernism, in my opinion. So I was fascinated with it. Also, it was doo-wop music, which is New York street corner homemade music, which I grew up with, and Latin music. And the combination of those two cultures was, to me, a very interesting combination. But neither of those forms had any history on Broadway. And I think that also contributed to, you know, to the critical response to it. It did bring in a lot of Hispanics, which was unusual for Broadway. It was not a community that went to the theater. And it was done in concert in recent years and got great reviews. So I would say it was a flawed piece of work that was probably 10 years ahead of its time.
Sorry, I'm going to go to the back. There's someone on the edge there. Is that okay? Sorry. I'm just trying to share it around. No, sorry. Up there. Yeah, no, yeah, just there. Yep, great. I feel terrible. I feel like
it
I
is me.
Okay.
Or something. Can you just talk for a moment, Paul, about your experience collaborating with studio musicians and how they help complete the work? I'm thinking specifically of a group like Steely Dan, who is notorious for working with, you know, revolving door of studio musicians, and what do they bring to the equation, and how satisfying do you find that experience?
Well, I enjoy it a lot because I pick the people that I'm going to work with very carefully now. So I pick players that whose work I admire, or you know, or who are specifically going to give me something that I want for a song. Like recently, I finished a song. It's the first song I finished in probably 3 years. And there was it was a guitar piece that I wrote. And one of the players in my band is very, very good keyboard player, works with Philip Glass, and that's how I know him. And he played on it, and then we used, instead of a bass, we used the bass notes of a harmonium. So it created an interesting sound. And then there was a composer named Harry Partch, not very well known at all. He died in 1973. But he composed in his own particular way. Harry Partch said, this concept that there are 12 notes in an octave is a completely arbitrary concept, which is admitted with, you know, the well-tempered clavier. Well-tempered meaning that they sort of fooled around with the notes to make them sound better when they work together, to try and explain this. If you take a wire and you stretch it between two points and it has a certain amount of tension in it, and you pluck that wire and it vibrates 440 times per second, it will produce the note A 440. And that's the note that symphony orchestra's tuned to, A 440. That's what it means. 440 times per second produces this sound. So the note, as you go up the scale, the physics of this produce different tones. But as you get to the notes that are a half step apart, like on a piano, between E and F and B and C, the physics, if you stayed with the physics, the notes wouldn't quite sound that great, which is why they call it tempered. They sort of detune the piano slightly because it sounds better to us. So Harry Partch said, that's just completely wrong. An octave doesn't have 12 notes, it has 37. It should be divided into 37 tones. So he wrote this microtonal music. And because instruments couldn't play microtonal music, he invented instruments. And then he composed this very interesting music. I mean, you would hardly call it melodic, but it is, it's very strange, but it is really interesting. Well, anyway, he died in 1973, and he left his instruments at Montclair University in New Jersey. And there's a composer named Dean Drummond who curates those instruments. And he also composes microtonally, as Harry Partch did. And as I was writing the context to this song, before the song was finished, just the guitar part and all this, I got in touch with him and went out and used these microtonal instruments to affect the sound that I was doing. The song was called The Insomniac's Lullaby, and it is called The Insomniac's Lullaby. And so I was using, you know, that. So now, at this point in my life, knowing so many people and great musicians, I can really pick how I want a track to sound, and I can go for it. Might not achieve it, but I can go for it. In the early days, you would either get assigned a group of musicians, like happened with The Sound of Silence, you know, where guys would come in and I'd play a song, and then everybody would try and figure out how to, you know, what the arrangement would be. Then, once we had a few hits, sometimes I would go to like a rhythm section that would be, you know, really well known, like there was a rhythm section that played in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, played a lot on a lot of hits. And I went down there and I recorded with them, and I think I recorded Kodachrome was down there, and Loves Me Like a Rock, and I don't know, three or four hits. Then the next group, the group that I described who sort of ran out of steam, that was these really brilliant guys who came into New York at a young age, and one of them, in fact, Steve Gadd, the drummer, he was the Steely Dan drummer. So when you get, and to show you the level of his creativity, he's the guy who made up that little drum beat that starts 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. I mean, he made it up. Same thing with the beat of Late in the Evening. So if you get really gifted studio musicians and they understand what you're doing and you understand what they're doing, you have a chance of, you know, creating something that's special. When it doesn't happen, which is what happened to me with the Hearts and Bones, I said, I don't want to go through this again. I'll go and find what's special and I'll make it, and then I'll figure out how to write the song. And if I don't like the song, I'll just throw the song out and begin again, which is a lot easier than taking 15 hours of studio time and six musicians and erasing that and starting all over again. Well, anyway, that's the way I thought.
And let's get one more question from...
Do you have to go to him? He's gonna,
yeah, there you go. He's in charge.
He's gonna be tortured if you don't. Go ahead.
Hello, Paul. Do you remember me?
No, but I probably will.
It was only 47 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm Ray Beattie from the Swindon Folk Club. Remember the Swindon Folk
Club?
Oh,
wow. Well, of course I do.
Yeah.
Sure.
See, what we haven't heard was when Paul spent his time as an itinerant musician traveling around the folk clubs of England.
Oh, that was the happiest days of my life, with the exception of this day today right here.
And he'd turn up in little towns and play a local gig, and we'd all sit around the pub. I was a cadet on the local newspaper in those days, and I managed to persuade my editor to let me do occasional reviews of Paul's pieces. But somebody nobody had ever heard of. And then the last time I saw him, there was a group of us sitting in this pub, and Paul was saying, "I've just come back from the States, and you won't believe it. You know, my manager has messed around with my record, and he's put all these musicians on the back of my record, and he's brought in Art Garfunkel, he's put him in as well. And they messed it all up. I couldn't even recognize my own music when I heard it."
No, that couldn't have happened. Because here's why. First of all, I didn't have a manager at the time. Second of all, Art Garfunkel and I made The Sound of Silence together. Mm-hmm. We sang it together. Right. So they wouldn't have brought him. So you've misremembered, but it's a good anecdote, so I wouldn't lose it.
Okay.
I'd stay with the anecdote.
Anyway, about a week later, it went to number one, and we never saw you again.
There you go.
Okay, yeah, that's a good anecdote.
Okay. Look, I read a fair bit about you traveling around England. That would have been a good topic, but that'll have to wait for another day. Thank you so much for giving us some of your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was great.